Blog Talk Radio.
The river I've been running ever since. It's been a long, long time coming, but I know change gon' come.
In the name of Allah, the Beneficent, the Merciful, to whom all praise is due, whom we forever thank for giving us the Honorable Elijah Muhammad as our leader, teacher, and guide. And I specifically, ladies and gentlemen, and brothers and sisters, open up like that because I am a representative of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. And were it not for him, you and I wouldn't be here today. In order for you and me to devise some kind of method or strategy to to offset some of the events or repetition of the events that have taken place here in Los Angeles recently, we have to go to the root. We have to go to the cause. Dealing with the condition itself is not enough. We have to get to the cause of it all, or the root of it all. And it is because of our effort toward getting straight to the root that people oftentimes think we are dealing in hate. But first, I would like to congratulate and give praise to the Negro, so-called Negro leaders and so-called Negro organizations. And excuse me if I say so-called, it's hard for me to just outright say Negro when I know what that word Negro really means. The person whom you have come to know as Ronald Stokes, we know him as Brother Ronald, one of the most religious persons who displayed the highest form of morals of any black person anywhere on this earth. And as one of the previous speakers pointed out who knew him, everyone who knew him had to give him credit for being a good man, a clean man, an intelligent man, and an innocent man when he was murdered. The Negro, so-called Negro organizations and leaders should be given great credit for their failure or refusal to let the white man divide them and use them one against the other during this crisis. As Reverend Wilfred Wilson pointed out, I think it was 8 years ago today that the Supreme Court handed down the desegregation decision. And despite the fact that 8 years have gone past, that decision hasn't been implemented yet. I don't have that much faith. I don't have that much confidence. I don't have that much patience. And I don't have that much ignorance if the Supreme Court, which is the highest law-making body in the country, can pass a decision that can't get even 8% compliance within 8 years, because it's for black people, then my patience has run out. When black people who are being oppressed become impatient, they say that's emotional. Please. When black people who are being deprived of their citizenship, not only of their civil rights, but their human rights, become impatient, become fed up, don't want to wait any longer, then they say that's emotional. The Negro, so-called Negro leaders and organizations should be praised. They should be congratulated. They should be complimented. Because out of all of them combined, the white man has not yet found one who will play the role of Uncle Tom. But yet he has found no Tom, no puppet, no parrot who is still dumb enough in 1962 to represent the injustices that he's afflicting against our people. We don't care what your religion is. We don't care what organization you belong to. We don't care how far in school you went or didn't go. We don't care what kind of job you have. We have to give you credit for shocking the white man by not letting him divide you and use you one against the other. In the past, the greatest weapon the white man has had has been his ability to divide and conquer. As Jackie Robinson pointed out beautifully on the television last night, 4/5 of the world isn't white. Isn't that what Jackie said? And if 4/5 of the world is dark, how is it possible for 1/5 to rule, oppress, exploit, dominate, and brutalize the 4/5 who are in the majority?
How do they do it?
Divide and conquer. If I take my hand and slap you, you don't even feel it. It might sting you because these digits are separated. But all I have to do to put you back in your place is bring those digits together. This is what the white man has done to you and me. He has divided us and used us one against the other. But today, thanks to Allah, you can say thanks to God or thanks to Jesus or thanks to Jehovah, whatever you want. But as a follower of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, we have been taught to say thanks to Allah. And that's what Jesus said. Jesus called on Allah. He said, Allah, Allah, lama asabatani. I believe what's good for Jesus is good for you. If Allah was good enough for Jesus to call upon, I think he should be good enough for you to call upon. Since the so-called Negro community has shot the white man by resisting all efforts to divide us, I think that you and I should continue to shock him by staying and working together in unity. Despite religious, political, economic, or educational, or social differences, let us remember that we're not brutalized because we're Baptist. We're not brutalized because we're Methodist. We're not brutalized because we're Muslim. We're not brutalized because we're Catholic. We're brutalized because we are black people in America. Here, your mother is being raped and you're not supposed to be emotional. Your women, please, your women can't walk the street without some cracker putting his hands on her, then you're not supposed to be emotional. If you say that you're fed up, if you teach the Negro, people don't even know their own name. Why? Because he took it away from them. Please, please. 20 million black people don't even know their own language. Why? Because he took it away from them. 20 million black people who don't even know the history of their ancestors. Why? Because he took it away from them. And if you try and tell them how thoroughly and completely they've been robbed, he says you're teaching hate. That's something to think about. Today, you are coming out of college. You're coming out of the leading universities. You're trying to go in a good direction, but you don't know which direction to go in. And if somebody tries to take you right to the root of your problem, they say that that man's a hate teacher. If I ask why should the senators in Washington, and then again, if we tell you that Negroes are being hung on the tree or being shot down illegally, unjustly, and those Negroes should do something to protect themselves, you say you're advocating violence. The white man is tricking you. He's trapping you. He doesn't call it violence when he lands troops in South Vietnam. Honey, please, please, please. He doesn't call it violence when he lands troops in Berlin. When the Japanese attacked Pearl Harbor, he didn't say get nonviolent. He said, praise the Lord, but pass the ammunition. But when someone attacks you,
when someone comes at you with a club, when someone comes at you with a rope, when someone comes at you with a gun, despite the fact that you've done nothing, he tells you, suffer peacefully. Pray for those who use you despitefully. Be long-suffering. And how long can you suffer after suffering for 400 years? So I just want to clear up that little point right there, because he says that we play on your emotions. And when you turn on your television tonight, or your radio, or read the newspaper, they're going to tell you in that paper that I was playing on your emotions. Imagine you, a second-class citizen. That's not getting emotional, it's getting intelligent. And as far as your mayor is concerned, I see you should say their mayor, a man named Yorty, who has been slandering the Muslims, a professional liar. Who has mastered the art of using half-truths, put it in the paper that they broke into our religious place of worship and got records that they can use to prove that most of us have criminal records. You can't be a Negro in America and not have a criminal record. Martin Luther King has been to jail. Please. James Farmer has been to jail. Why, you can't name a black man in this country who is sick and tired of the hell that he's catching who hasn't been to jail. Charged him with being seditious. They put Moses in jail. They put Daniel in jail. Why, you haven't got a man of God in the Bible that wasn't put to jail when they started speaking out against exploitation and oppression. They charged Jesus with sedition. Didn't they do that? They said he was against Caesar. They said he was discriminating. Because he told his disciples, go not the way of the Gentiles, but rather go to the lost sheep. He discriminated. Don't go near the Gentiles, go to the lost sheep. Go to the oppressed. Go to the downtrodden. Go to the exploited. Go to the people who don't know who they are, who are lost from the knowledge of themselves, and who are strangers in a land that is not theirs. Go to those people. Go to the slaves. Go to the second-class citizens. Go to the ones who are suffering the brunt of Caesar's brutality. And if Jesus were here in America today, he wouldn't be going to the white man. The white man is the oppressor. He would be going to the oppressed. He would be going to the humble. He would be going to the lowly. He would be going to the rejected and the despised. He would be going to the so-called American Negro. To have once been a criminal is no disgrace. To remain a criminal is the disgrace. I formerly was a criminal. I formerly was in prison. I'm not ashamed of that. You never can use that over my head. And that he's using the wrong stick. I don't feel that stick. I went to prison because I believed in men like Sam Yorty. I went to prison because I trusted men like Sam Yorty. I went to prison following the philosophy of men like Sam Yorty. But since I've been following the Honorable Elijah Muhammad, I have been reformed, and that's more, please. That's more than Sam Yorty and Chief Parker and all these other white politicians have been able to do with the inmates in the prisons of this state. They should give Mr. Muhammad credit. They should give Mr. Muhammad credit. for reforming and rehabilitating men whom they have failed to reform and rehabilitate.
Mayor Jordan
referred to some press report that Mr. Muhammad had once been found guilty of contributing to the delinquency of a minor. He failed to explain purposely that in 1934, the Honorable Elijah Muhammad refused to send his children to the white schools in Detroit, Michigan that were teaching you about little black Sambo. That's the minor that he contributed to the delinquency of. You see, this vicious, fork-tongued white man has been able to take lives and make you turn against those who want to help you and make others turn against you. This is the contributing to the delinquency of a minor that this mayor, or man who calls himself mayor, is talking about. In the same article, he said that the Muslims are the same people who rioted in the United Nations. Someone should pull his coat and let him know that at the present moment, there are $6 million worth of suits leveled against two of New York's leading newspapers for making the mistake of charging the Muslims as being involved in those United Nations riots. We were not involved. And if this fork-tongued man who calls himself your mayor had taken the time to find that out, he wouldn't be walking into the trap that he's letting his ignorance lead him into. And if he would take the time to read the Washington Post that came out the Sunday after that incident took place, the Washington Post pointed out on the front page that the Muslims had nothing to do with the UN riots. And they quoted, in saying so, the person who was at that time the commissioner of police in New York City. See, it's lies that the white man has spread about the Muslims to try and make you afraid of the Muslims, or to try and make you think that the Muslims were a criminal element, an uncouth element, and things that you would not like to be associated with. Also, they say that, I'm just clearing these things up, and then we're going to get into what happened. They also say that the Honorable Elijah Muhammad was a draft dodger. No, he wasn't. He just refused to go to the army because he was a man of peace. He was a minister of a religion of peace. He was teaching peace. So he outright refused to go to the army. That's not draft dodging. That's intelligence. Appear before the grand jury. Because the coroner's jury is stacked against Negroes. The grand jury is stacked against Negroes. The press, the radio, the television, and the newspapers are stacked against Negroes.
Black power, black power, black nation. You're tuned into In Defense of the People weekly Tuesday night broadcast at 7 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Eastern with your host, People's Political Party National Chair, Nat Turner, co-host myself, National Minister of Defense, Brother Motherland, and our engineers on the ones and twos, National Minister of Communication, Sister Amina, calling each and every Tuesday night, same black place, same black time at 845-277-9266. Press 1 to participate. Tonight's topic, the tentacles of white supremacy, part 2. We're going to open up our phone lines to our national chairman, Nat Turner, black power comrade. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir, brother. Right on. I can hear you loud and clear. Yeah, you're right, man. See, black power. Black people, particularly, you know, all powerful people. In general, you know, the black and brown, you know, people, a larger non-white society, not only here, but around the world, because that's what this show is all about. Continuation from last week. I left off, discussing how the tentacles of white supremacy you know, they reach into what's called the education sector of this country, of this so-called government, the schooling system, and particularly the, who you refer to as the public school system, since it would appear that most of our youth, black youth, children, teenagers, attend what is considered public schools, the public school system. Certain parts of the South, you know, those who have become politicized, conscious revolutionaries, we renamed it the public school system. But the simple fact that the school system, it makes fools out of our youth, prepares them for nothing. Collectively, take a certain tiny segment of our youth, place them in another category, you know, give them these accolades and awards and stuff, you know. What W.E.B. Du Bois has stated as a tale of intent about 100 years ago. Those of us now were old enough to understand, and when we were in high school, we didn't really grasp the full meaning of it. It was something that, you know, it seems so benevolent and so beautiful until we come into consciousness and realize that in essence what it is if you had 10 young people in the room and one or two of them, you know, made sure these, you know, this knack, you know, to make all A's. You know, but that doesn't mean the other 9 in the room are dumb. You know, there's this very dangerous, sinister labeling, which has played a role in our division. But I'd said last week, and 1 or 2 times before passed, that our children who were deemed as such heaping praise on them and going to these higher education and whatnot and studying such things as physics and chemistry and biology and whatnot, you know, science and technology. And when you take those fields into consideration, what does the empire do with that? What can you get out of learning physics, chemistry, and science and technology? What comes out of that in terms of material production? You know? And the thing that come to mind is weapons of mass destruction. What they accused of Saddam Hussein of having in order to take over Iraq. And our youth or some black genius would be given a position to make that happen. And when we weigh it, he could only do 1 or 2 things. He can make a bomb, and he can drop the bomb on his own people, or he'll drop the bomb on the so-called white man. And this may seem problematic for some, but it's a reality that is come to pass in a sense. It's realistic. It's not some type of fantasy, what have you. But that's what it is in a nutshell. And this is what white supremacy does, non-whites. This is the so-called predicament that white supremacy places non-whites in. It's like damned if you do, damned if you don't. You know, so if you look around the world and you take this, you know, the non-whites of the earth who represent the overwhelming majority of the people in this planet. And the empire takes from each non-white group its talent and intent and heaps, you know, showers of praise on them, provides for them, makes life easy for them, opens up doors for them, channels to access to material luxury, you know, to have the same things that, you know, the rich whites or even middle class whites have had easier access to in such a material world. You know, we're all materialistic in one way, shape, or form or some fashion. From the historical materialist perspective, you know, the creation of things and whatnot. And so, you know, here in America, you know, these labels of these different groups, and then I'm going to try my best to try to tie this in because they're all interconnected. You know, it's like that commercial where they showed a so-called, used to be this commercial with the telegraph, telecation, you know, communications people, IT&T, or ITT. And they would make this commercial and show all these, like these lines and these points, and they would connect, you know, around the world. It was like in elementary school a long time ago, they used to have these little books, these little small, like little pamphlets, like little books, like something like maybe about 3x6 or something like that, you know. And inside they would have these images, but the images was based on the dots, on the page, and the numbers were like scrambled all over the place. It wasn't like one was it. Two was next to one, and three was next to two, and four was next to five. Like one was over here to the left, and two was on at the bottom right, and you know three was up at the top right, and stuff like that. So they taught us we were taught to connect the dots by the numbers. So when we connect the dots by the numbers, you know we find it interesting, you know, and it sort of like captivated our minds because our curiosity was peaking the more and more and more that we connect these dots. And these, it may have been like, you know, 45 numbers on it all over the page. And so by the time we got through connecting, you know, the numbers, you know, we realized it was a picture of something. And like, for instance, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, right? One was at the top. And two was down at the bottom right, and three was at the top left of the one, and four was right of the one, and so forth, you know, sort of like that. And we connected these points. We realized we had drawn a star. To give you an example, 5-pointed star. So this is what you know, that commercial that used to come on years ago, you know, for some of us who can remember. And it's like around the world, you know, connecting things around the world because they're connected. And so labeling here in America, we have the so-called different races or ethnic groups, right? And, you know, white, black, Hispanic, East Asian, Arab American, and so forth. You know, Pacific Islander, whatever. And labeling these groups in a classificatory hierarchy or structure. And this goes back to the 18th century. And I've mentioned this too, where these so-called anthropologists, whatever, these ethnologists in the 18th century, like 1760s, 70s, and 80s and whatnot, and they would take it upon themselves to, you know, look out over the world that was known to them, and due to the travels of Marco Polo and all these different so-called adventurers in the 16th century, what have you, 14th, 15th centuries. And they made this movie back in the 80s, I believe, the 70s or the 80s. And it was, I remember coming on NBC, you know, when it was national broadcasting channels. And it would come on Sunday nights, and it was composed of a miniseries about Marco Polo and his travels to the Far East, to the Orient. And so they named what is called East Asia the Oriental world. And in the West, they referred to themselves as the Occidental world. And this is how white supremacy works. This is its tentacles to condition people. And so the Orient was like given this, like this exotic place, like, you know, the animals and even the people. And so they made this whole romantic thing about Marco Polo, so much so that the psychology of Marco Polo has become this sort of game in the pool, you know. And even the movie How Stella Got a Groove Back, you know, with Tay Diggs and, you know, I forget her name, but she plays, you know, the actress, right, the old actress. And, you know, he comes, or he meets her son and her little cousin, and he jumps in the pool. Marco Polo, it's so much so to that. And this is how these things affect us, right? And so this legacy of Marco Polo over in the East, like this Far East-like type place, and they would venture out. And the cultural annihilation, or the attempts of it, or the confiscation of one's culture, which is the basis of a people's existence, you know, their language, the way they worship, the way their style of dress, the even way they keep their hair, you know. And the Europeans would venture out and they would record these things and they would study these things and whatnot. And then they would take it back to the camp and then take it upon themselves to start labeling people. And we've internalized this shit like wholeheartedly. Such terms as pagan, primitive, polytheism, which means, you know, worshiping more than one god, false gods. You know, the nine whites, they were polytheists, and the Europeans and the whites were monotheists. You know, monotheism, you know, that kind of thing, you know, the one god, and they believed in all these false gods. And so when they were labeled the different groups, you know, there's one particular person who had generated some type of fame, like in the school of anthropology, named Johann Blumenbach, and he drew a conclusion, you know, the so-called five different races on the earth, you know, it's Caucasian, Mongolian, Ethiopian, American Indian, and Malaysian. And there was only one of that group that was white, European, pale skin. Everybody else was people of color. And so when he drew the conclusion of which one of these groups is intellectually superior to the other, which one was ranked first in IQ and all this shit, he would actually choose his own type, the Caucasians. You know? And that was the beginning of the end. And so since 1775, at least, 1760s, all of us in America has been using the word Caucasian. We've been saying Caucasian, Caucasian, Caucasian. But the one word we didn't say in America was Ethiopian. We didn't say Ethiopian because they replaced the word Ethiopian with nigger. And nigger went from to Negro, from nigger to Negro. You know, from Negro to Black American, then from Black American to Black, and then from Black to Afro-American. This is when someone's able to control your thought process, your psyche like that, do you know more or no less than his slave? Until you can take your mind back from that type of slavery and find out who you really are, what you really are, where you came from, and all of that. Because one thing white people won't do is allow no other group to dictate to them what and who they are, or to relabel them. You know, they'll always look back to Europe, Western Europe. Western Europe will always look back to the Romans, and the Romans will always look back to the Greeks. And the Greeks would always look back much more darker days. The one word called barbarianism or barbarism. You know, because it starts to get real muddy there. It starts to become very, very unclear as to white so-called civilization, civilized people beyond the Greeks. It starts to get difficult. You know, so they start carving out, you know, these histories, these pre-Greek histories, Mycenaean civilization or whatnot, you know, these terms. And, man, you know, it takes a while to grasp these things. And every time, you know, we get on these types of subjects, like, you know, historical type shit, it's hard to not think about Malcolm X. No, who is the greatest thinker this country ever produced? And I'll put him up against anybody. And I mean anybody. No. But he was one of the young comrades used to say spot on or something like that. No, but realizing that you know, like this historical analysis, it paints the picture so much clearer. And a lot of us don't realize it. A lot of us don't really understand it. And due to the conditioning, the only history that we really, you know, care about or would, you know, like really like try to focus on is the history class curriculum that they give to you in school, because you can't graduate without it. So you're forced to take it. So you're forced to go along with it. You force to internalize the shit that they teach you in these books, you know, world history or whatever, you know, and it wouldn't dawn on you like, you know, you're like a father or mother has a child that's in middle school, high school, whatever. And, you know, you issue your child issue a book, like, you know, first couple of days of class. And that is coming upon a child to take care of that book, whatever, whatnot, you know. But it doesn't dawn on that young person to open the book up and look at the contributors in the book. You know, it has a list of contributors in the book, you know, and all of them, you know, they got their name with their little credentials and all the kind of shit underneath it, you know, whatever, Bill Johnson, you know, you know, how they give themselves all these titles, you know, professor, so-and-so, all this kind of shit, you know, associate professor, assistant is that, and, you know, I mean, there's all these words, all these extravagant words that they apply, you know, there's a list of them, and you go down that list, and you don't see pretty much anything but Europeans there. Now, there may be some who may beg to differ, but in general, that book is dominated by Europeans. Now, think about this. You have in these little occupied colonies of America where black people are concentrated at, not where black people live. It's a difference. And this is what's going to get us over the hump. This is what's going to get us on the right track. When we start really thinking about these labels and these terms, what is the reality? What is the real shit? Like, what is the most practical term that we can use to label a place where black people live in? Everybody else has come up with these words. And, of course, due to our experience, we brought our own shit. But what I'm saying is you have school districts, schools, some of 95% black student body. You know, high numbers, like, right? You know, down to, let's say, like 60%, right? But the history book is put together by Europeans, right, in general. Now, they may say, well, you know, man, you know what, brother, man, that shit was 30 years ago, 40, 50, 60, you know, blah, blah, man, it's not like that now, man. You know, it is a multicultural affair, man, you know, what natural. And they'll even point out, you know, the dude got an African name. You know, they even point him out. He's got an African. This one dude, man, quite cool. You know, Elijah Wine, man. He contributed to the book. I said, okay, well, that's cool. Right on. That's a progress. I said, you what? Let's look at quite cool Elijah Wine's mindset. Let's look at him. Let's examine him. You know, how about we sit Brother Kwaku cool down and ask him in two veins, one in private and one on the camera on CNN, and ask him, who was the ancient Egyptians? Were they black? And if they gave him the opportunity to write about the Egyptians part, version, or section in the, you know, world history section, right? Ancient civilizations, right? Would he, would say that the Egyptians are black, would he quote that in the book that he's been given the responsibility? He's been given a responsibility to write about the Egyptians and starting with who they were, right? Instead of telling what Egypt has on the map and then leapfrog over to the pyramids, you know, shit like that. And this is what white supremacy does. This is the tentacles of white supremacy in the academic world. Now, obviously, Brother Kwaku would be placed in the what may be a predicament. Now, he has one or two choices, right? If there's this ethics, high professional standards, you know how this shit, they always, you know, every university claims to have these high moral ethical values and something go down at the school and one of the professors, you know, got caught on camera in the restroom saying nigga and he didn't know he was on film and then some student put it out on posting on social media and then the school get wind of it and then they have with me first thing they do, they want to separate themselves from him, you know, they want to, you know, set themselves apart. And then, you know, they get the school president or whoever, a spokesperson, or, you know, they hold a press conference and shit on CNN and on Fox all over the world or whatever, even BBC got it. That's British television, right? And what does he do? He bring up all that old shit, you know. Well, you know, our university has high, you know, ethical standards and, you know, you know, I go, we've seen that over and over and over and over and over again, right? The whole shit. So he does that, you know. You know, the same old thing. Now, just picture Brother Kwaku not having to resort to the same high ethical standards, which would place him in a position to tell the truth or to appease the white supremacists. And it goes back to that young, brilliant black scientist who has studied physics and chemistry and all this kind of shit, right? And it goes back to the same thing. And then you go through Jesus in the equation. It really gets messy. It really gets complicated. It really gets messed up. He's in one heck of a position. He has to make the best decision that he can make. Now, which decision that, what is his moral values? What is his values? His values is placed on what? His values is placed on what? Chances is his values is placed on material values and comfort. Because after all, that's what he went to school for. Especially, you know, the rags to riches story, you know, like on ESPN, they show you the 30 for 30 thing and whatnot, show you how some of these football players that came from nothing. Their moms worked 2.5 jobs, and you had to juggle him between the aunt, the big sister, the grandmother, and the mama. There was nothing but black women in the picture. No dad, right? The closest person me up come to, in a sense, if the dad didn't have a brother or uncle or a big brother, whatever, then it was a dude on the block, right? And so we know how that can go. Take your pick, A, B, C, D, or E. Take your pick. So, you know, we have to make these decisions. You know, he comes and does these things, and after all, he makes. So which one would he make? You know, and this is what it's about. This is what it boils down to. And it ain't always easy. It ain't always easy. It ain't always easy. But this is the predicament that white supremacy puts people in. Certain black people in a certain environment, in a certain world, the so-called academic world. So, Brother Kwaku, I'd ask you one or two things. You must tell the truth and fear no one, fear no backlash or none of that, or don't tell the truth and go along with the white supremacists and just make the Egyptians some abstract entities. You know, or to compromise. This is what they do. And I'll give you an example of somebody who done that. Compromise. What is the compromise? Well, the compromise is, well, a portion of the ancient Egyptian civilization, you know, indeed was black. There, you know, it was indeed Negroid. You know, a portion of it was Negro. It's amazing how they do this. And these are kind of things, and I don't know what to refer to, but political education class. You know, when it comes to our youth, our children, and that's why they're out there doing what they're doing. You know? The average new has got to the point where school is boring. You know, it's, you know, they struggle to make it through, what, 8 hours, 7 hours, whatever, school, 6 hours of school, you know, and can't wait till the bell ring or, you know, to be ready to roll out, you know, so they can posse up, you know. But this is the happens to take place, you know. So the compromise, part of the Negro, the ancient Egyptian population, yeah, it was indeed, you know, looked like, you know, black people in America, you know, they were considered black and, you know, Negro, you know, these terms, there was a Negro element in ancient Kemet. There was a black scholar, intellectual scholar. His name was Frank Snowden. And he wrote this book called, I think it was Blacks in Antiquity or something, right? And his thesis, his goal, his objective was to prove that there was indeed black element, not only in Kemet, but elsewhere, even in the Greek world, you know? And so, when you read his book, you ain't know any better. You know, you be like, yeah, right on. But Frank Snowden compromised. That's what he did. He compromised so he wouldn't, you know, end up over here bad or end up over there, definitely not end up over here bad, you know, with the white conservative intellectual scholars who got the nerve to call themselves Egyptologists, ancient historical experts on ancient Egypt and other kind of shit, right? And so he compromised, you know. And even today, as of late, as a matter of fact, I mean, there was some, you know, our Minister of Defense had pointed out earlier, we were talking last week, similar, and somehow the Queen Cleopatra movie that was made, if I'm understanding that correctly, starring Elizabeth Taylor, you know, she was 50 years ago, something like that, right? And how she played Cleopatra and whatnot. Charlton Heston would play White Moses. You know, the two big actors and actresses back in the day. They were like big time and shit, right? Like Gwyneth Paltrow is today. You know, the ladies, what her name, Angelina Jolie, something like whatever. You know, big time white actresses. Well, that's what Elizabeth Taylor was 56 years ago. And, you know, they made these movies. And so, again, that's what Snowden did. You know, and he knew that they could not refute that portion, because this portion that he's talking about, they had no choice, right? So even the hardliners, but there's the extreme whites, the very staunch extreme whites, will try to even explain that away and thin up. But what I'm saying is, there's this science called anthropology. You know, there's a specialization studying a skull, you know, the nose, socket, the eye, you know, the nose, the eye, the brow area, the forehead area, the back of the head, you know, the ear, the chin, the jaws, I mean, every little nook and cranny of the skull. And so there's these certain features that certain black people have. Now, notice what I said. There's these certain features that certain black people have. You see, this is what breaks the mold of white supremacy. So there's certain features that certain black people have. Now, these certain features that black people have, they found numerous skulls in these graves in Kemet, right? Like 6,000 years old. And it was irrefutable that the skulls of the skeletons possessed these features exactly like certain black people. Okay, like certain black people that lived back in the 50s and the 60s, right? Who had to ride the back of the bus, who obviously got called nigger, who on their birth certificate had Negro written on it. I don't know when they stopped that. When they stopped, you know, like specifically, like, but I know like those of us who was born in the 60s, our birth certificate had Negro on it. So often maybe to the 70s and whatnot like that, right? So these particular skeletons, they found hundreds of them, right? And so they're so good, but damn, this is what Snowden knew. He was aware of that. He was aware. And, of course, the artwork. There's certain sculptures that were found, and they had wide nose, full lips, and whatnot. And so, he was a Negro. But this one here wasn't, because his nose wasn't wide, and he didn't have full lips. See? Look at that. You know, the painting shows the sculpture. You know? And so what they did was created another group, another name. You know, anything but Negro, because Negroes don't have these features, so they couldn't have been Negroes. There was somebody else. They was Egyptians, but they weren't Negroes. Snowden was aware of this. He was aware of this. But it's an excellent book. Anybody want to get interested in like ancient civilization and history, or even the Greek world? I mean, it's an excellent book. Well, his research is impeccable. Nobody compromised with the academic world. And this is what white supremacy does to a black man who wanted to make something of himself. Learn his history. Go back in time and learn the ancient civilization. You know, sitting right in Northeast Africa. And you take Northeast Africa and say, oh, it belonged to the Middle East because it's so-called Egypt. And this is one of the most crucial parts of white supremacy, because it's very important that white supremacy confiscates a ancient black Egyptian civilization. It makes all the difference in the world to them. And we don't be realizing this shit. You know, like when Napoleon went to Kemet with his whole team, you know, like I said, he had brought a whole squad with him, especially these artists. And I'll give it to them. You know, they were a heck of an artist. But when they came upon this giant head that was sticking out of the sand, right? They looked and saw it and said, whoa, this is a Negro facial structure. And as I said, you know, there's certain features that just makes it indisputable. Because white people don't have them all together. They just don't have them. They might have one or two of them. But all of them, they just don't have it. Right? So when they saw it, it was like, whoa, this is what became known as the Sphinx. And at that time, go to show you how to transmit, how the geographical landscape of the earth can change. And it was up to his head, like, you know, his neck, like, you know, insane. And so they took up on the task to remove the sand because they wanted to see what was underneath, like what it was attached to, what more. And when they finally, you know, was able to, you know, accomplish this yeoman's job, it was attached to a body of a lion. And that's what became known as the Sphinx. But what Napoleon's artists did when they sketched the head, they changed the nose and the lips. And he took out the sloping face. There's this angular sloping face that certain black people have, right? And this jutting out of the jaws, you know. And they use all these terms, German terms, whatnot, these old-ass terms that, like, again, that they use to apply to things, non-white. And so his artist changed all of that. And you can go and look. Don't take my word. You can go and look and see the sketches. And then pull up a real photo of the Sphinx and compare the two together. And when your child see the sketch, the child wouldn't even know any better. And it becomes an incumbent upon his elders, providing that even they had become conscious of it. This is why our children, our youth are out there doing what they're doing. And they say, well, how is that so? How is that so? It doesn't take a rocket scientist to know that when you instill in any children their heroes, their culture, the people that came before them that accomplished things look just like them. It's inspirational. Nah, tell me I'm wrong. And I'll give you the perfect example. You don't think it has anything to do with it. I'll give you one, Barack Obama. When Barack Obama came out of nowhere and became president, what happened? The first thing you hear, inspiration to young people, to young black people, especially to young black boys. Not only here in America, they took the shit around the world. Dads from Africa, Kenya, where the Kenyans had to struggle against the British, became known as the Mau Mau underground guerrilla army. So they had to struggle there. The Africans, the Kenyans had to struggle there. They formed the Kenya African Union, became known as the KAU. But due to the British propaganda, labeled them as the Mau Mau. And so not only was Obama an inspiration to black boys in America, but he was an inspiration to black boys and youth in Kenya. And not only in Kenya, throughout Africa. And these people set up their media cameras wherever they had niggas at. And they can show black people celebrating all around the world, but in particularly Africa. And what did they say about Obama? So how is Obama important? Why should Obama be an inspiration to black boys and black youth? Why should he? Why should he? How could he? And if not, what takes place? And this is the dots that we have to connect. But white supremacy chose one over the other. Well, the Spence couldn't be black, but Obama could because we own him. And I know that may sound offensive, and it may anger some of us who listen. This ain't no personal kick. This ain't no emotional thing. It is what it is. It is what it is. But that's the importance of a piece of ancient black history, that Sphinx, the largest stone carving that we know today on this earth, and what its symbolism is, what its symbolism means, right? It's an old riddle that's supposed to be known by such secret societies or groups or private groups, whatever, known as the Freemasons, right? The numbers involved, you know, this number, right? What starts off on all fours, later goes on twos, and ends up on threes. Four, three, two, four, two, six, and three more is nine. And that is the life cycle. The old riddle that went into the Sphinx, the riddle of the Sphinx. Right? 432. And that number 432 is symbolic. Please cycle. 9 months of what? You know, count the holes in your body as a male, but then count the holes in your body as a female and see how many you get. You know, this is our legacy, our history. But again, it has to be confiscated. Because after all, Egypt has been seen as the world's greatest civilization ever built. And that's what the Europeans say. Planet is well old. And so that's why they keep digging. And keep digging 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 and digging and digging and digging and digging. In what they call the so-called Middle East. No. And the more you go back, the blacker it gets. The older the monuments, they stay black. Not they got black, they stayed black. And back and back and back and back. And even, like I said, like these sculptures, these paintings, that's art. That's art. Even in Zimbabwe, the ancient ruins of Zimbabwe, in southern Africa, these ancient ruins. The Europeans could not let the cat out the bag that in Zimbabwe, these ruins go back to, what, 1,000 years probably, or more, you know? And it says nowhere in the world that these Africans could have built this. Somebody else had to do it. Some white men must have came in and built this shit. There's nowhere in the world these Africans could have done that. They didn't have the knowledge, the understanding, they don't know where in the world. They know nothing about physics. None of that. Mathematics, science, none of that. Geometry. You know, all these mathematical equations and whatnot. This thing I remember when I was in school was referred to as the Pythagorean theorem. A squared plus B squared equals C squared. And you get a triangle on those. But no, we were not taught. It was not brought to our attention that this equation went into the creation of the structures, pyramids. You know, the computation of the earth, the dimensions of the earth, all of that is recorded in one of the pyramids in Kemet, what they call the Great Pyramid. You know, the circumference of the earth, you know, the diameter, all of this recorded into this one monument. This is nowhere in the world these niggas could have did this. As a matter of fact, the aliens done. What did they knew they, well, they knew they didn't do it. When the air went out of that bag, they had to find somebody else to have done that. because the niggas couldn't have done it. So, shit, we'll blame this on the aliens. Or if the niggas did do it, the aliens gave them the knowledge to do it. And right now, if you look at the History Channel, you see this thing called Ancient Aliens that come on History Channel every, I think, like Friday, something like that. And you see this one dude with he got a Greek name. Can't get his name out right now. Tsoukalos or something like that. And he's like the leader of the pack. And he goes all around the world more times than not to 9 white ancient civilizations and structures and brings up this alien shit. That's what white supremacy does. This is the new sophisticated way of denying ancient black civilizations or civilizations that were built by black people 10,000 years ago, further back than what they tell us. Like the Sphinx is older than what it is. The Great Pyramid, the large, it's older than what they tell us what it is. And they have to control it. They have to really control it. And so this is the ancient part of it. What they refer to as the Sumerian civilization, you know, what today, what right now today is known as Iraq. To those of you, of us who read the Bible, who Genesis, you know, the table of nations and whatnot, the family tree and whatnot, right? You know, Noah, his sons, and their sons, and that stuff. You may know it as Mesopotamia in the Bible, which is simply a word that means the land between the two rivers. Like what they refer to as Mesoamerica, right? Middle America, right? And Meso in the middle is the same root structure, right? Middle. It just simply means middle. And with the Sumerian civilization in Iraq, and here's another thing what they did with ancient Kemet. When that ran out, when they could no longer hold up white Egyptians, and had to give way to at least 9 white Egyptians, right? This term called Hamite, right? Now Hamite, of course, you know, it wouldn't take a genius to realize where the word come from. Ham, one of the sons of Noah, right? And I'm telling you, it's all connected. I just hope I can, you know, connect the dots, you know, because it's so much. Okay, so goes back to the word Negro, those skulls, or they were Negro. It's okay, well, but the Egyptians are overwrought with Hamites, you know, to kill that Negro shit. Like I say, you know, if you have 10 people in a room, the white supremacist will say, well, yeah, one or two of them was Negroid. The rest was Hamites. You wouldn't know any better. You don't know you were a Hamite. You don't know you're a Hamite. The black people in this country, we Hamites. If you took the Bible and if you came from the perspective of the Bible, we all Hamites. Every last one of us. Every last one of us. And if you go to Africa, every indigenous person in Africa is a Hamite, regardless of their height, their head texture, nose width, lip size, skin complexion, right? We're the most diverse people this earth has ever gave birth to. Ever. And we're all Hamites. But the trick is to split us up into factions. Them Negroes and these Hamites right here. Which would lead to what? Internus and strife. But according to the scripture, we're all Hamites. Because according to the 10th chapter of Genesis, it's the father of the people that populated Africa, or the people who, you know, grew up in Africa, you know, became the first indigenous inhabitants of that part of the world. Damn. And we know that Ham is supposed to be a Hebrew word, which means black. Now, you say, now wait, hold up, brother. Now you're going too far. When it was talking about Ham was black, it wasn't talking about the man Ham was black. It's just that his name was black. Now, how could that be? How could that be? Here you have a, you want me to believe that a man named was Ham, whose father was named Noah, and I'm supposed to believe Noah was a real man, Ham was a real man, and then they tell me what Ham names mean, it means black, all of a sudden he's not black, though. So what did they do? They had to betray him as white. So into Hollywood, they made that movie, Noah's Ark. And then they made another one after that, and then they made another after that. Now, this is another thing that white supremacy does. The Hollywood faction of white supremacy does what? Or the Hollywood wing of white supremacy does what? Every so-so, it regenerates the movie. Every so-so, it remakes the movie. You know why? Because every generation or every other generation has to continually be socially engineered into this white Noah shit and history sermons. So they go, so 10, 15 years from now, somebody who's an aspiring actor gonna be chosen to be the next Noah in the movie. Unless Spike Lee or whoever else, all the dudes that made the movies back in the 80s and the 90s, you know, Harlem Nights, all of that. Bill Duke, all them dudes that made those movies. With the Hustling Brothers or something like that, whatever. Whole gang of them, including the newer ones. Unless one of them got the balls, or like sister used to say, the breasts, to go find four actors. One has to be an older one, of course. And the other three has to be young in him to play the songs and produce their own movie. Like the sister who made Queen and Slim. Good movie. I was with it all the way up to the end. So she owed me one, speaking personal, as a black man. Right? Nah. One of them have to do it. Because we'd be out of our minds to think one of them going to come along and keep doing that. As a matter of fact, actor Blair Underwood, maybe 20-something years ago probably, and I'll tell you who else in a minute who commented on it, actor Blair Underwood was in the process of playing Jesus in a production of Jesus. Yeah. And it was a quiet storm. Not a quiet storm. What should I say? Well, quietly behind the scenes, rather, which is what made me say that. It was a rebellion. And it never happened. Now, who rebelled? The white supremacists rebelled. And in the meantime, in the interim, Madonna spoke out a long time ago about time that the truth, according to her, be put on the screen. And she said it herself, that a black man played Jesus, because Jesus was black. Right? And this reminds me of something else. The incident with Sean Puffy Combs, who always changing his name every so and so. A video that was produced, I can't necessarily think who it was, but the video was produced where they actually portrayed a black Jesus in the movie, in the video. Sean Combs was part of that. And to my understanding, MTV was asked to edit the video, and it didn't happen to something. And so there was an incident with Sean Puffy Combs at, was it Universal Records or something? And they worked over some guy that worked in there. And he never did no time for that. over this Black Jesus thing. And his spiritual advisor was the Reverend Calvin Butts. You can look this up. Don't take my word for it. His spiritual advisor was Reverend Calvin Butts, who in actuality, if you listen to the song with Scarface and Ice Cube, Hand to the Dead Body, and listen to Ice Cube's verse, where he talks about the Reverend Calvin Butts, do we got a pair of nuts? That's what he was talking about. Not only that, and some other shit too. And like I said, all these things is connected. And this is what white supremacy does. The tentacles of white supremacy. So like I said, it was school days, Hostella Got a Groove Back, all these movies, Boys in the Hood, Poetic Justice, you know. Until one of our own put a production team together and make a movie. Now, let me say this. This episode that happened with Will Smith and Chris Brown, I got to laugh. And let me say this too. If anybody listening would like to comment, question, you know, just press the one on your phone, you know, at the end of the queue, and we'll get you in. You know what I'm saying? For the record. But this episode with Will Smith and Chris Rock, you know, seen live on television, right, or whatever. You know, nothing came out of that, right? And, you know, this backlash against Will Smith, I think he was kicked out of the, he's on, part of this board with Oscar, whatever that shit is. So you never know what some of these dudes done got themselves into unless it comes, something happened with the shit, draw it out, right? Well, anyway, one thing after the next, like, dude, and several people come to mind, even Bill Cosby. But Will Smith, though, some of this kind of strikes him as interesting. Quiet as kept. Well, he's actually in the midst of producing his own movie, right? Yeah, producing his own movie, you know. And I talked with one or two persons, you know, who was able to, you know, sort of enlighten me. And it was dawning on me that this thing, it made me look at the Chris Rock shit differently. It made me look at it different. You know what I'm saying? His persecution, right? And all these things that happened. And it, you know, even Bill Clinton said nothing has about coincidence. But Will Smith having made all his money and played in all these movies and the particular roles he played in. Like, he was ordered to play in these movies, positioned to play in these movies. And notice this, too. These comedians, pay attention to this shit. These comedians who have been given these big-time blockbuster roles in these big-time blockbuster movies, who we got? Martin Lawrence, Chris Rock, Will Smith. Them the three that come to mind. Right? Given these roles beyond being a comedian, beyond a comedic role, right? Which may have just a little tint of comedian in it. And it all played in these movies that had to do with what? It had to do with what? I've had these conversations with, you know, with my comrade, you know, some of this stuff, you know what I'm saying? But it had to do with what? It had to do with intelligence. All the movies had something to do with intelligence. Right? And in those movies, in each one of those movies, in each roles, they what? They totally oblivious to the real world. Totally oblivious. And if you think that's a coincidence, you kidding yourself. And they put who? Older white men in these roles. And what they're saying to you is this here. Look, the reason why we're able to dominate is because we this. And the only way you can get like us if you come through us. And that is the perception. Just like they did in Africa. The colonialization of Africa. The so-called scramble for Africa. But yeah, Will Smith, enemy of the state. Chris Rock, I can't think of any movie. But he plays the twin brother of a CIA agent who was working overseas and he got murdered. He got killed. In the middle of an operation. And so they track his twin down and they find him. Right? And you can kind of see the movie with Chris Tucker too. Where he plays the hustler and he ends up in something and the mob, these Russian mob, whatnot, stuff like that. They end up at the Coliseum. You know, I can't think of any movie, you know. But just these movies, they all comedians. They're all comedians. They're taking black comedians and give them these roles. And they give them these roles because they can take them serious. No one takes a comedian serious. Even in the real world, when you see him in the real world, you can't even take him serious because you've been so socialized to see him as a comedian. When you see him, so you might be out one night, you know, in the club or something, whatever, you know, and it may be a something weekend going on or whatever, and you want to go, and in walks Chris Tucker. You know, you look, you can't see him serious. You can't take him serious. So they put him in a movie because you can't take him serious. They're nine beings. They're nine entities. And the only way they can be taken serious is if they're the ones who get them there. They're the ones who get there. Now, it gets a little close if you take Ice Cube. When you play in one of the Triple X movies, right? They give him certain specific lines. Now, all this is by design. All this shit, this is what white supremacy, attempted with white supremacy. This is what it does. And you, man, tell you, some of these things, you know, small things, but they could spark a revolution. And so in Ice Cube's world, right, in Triple X, first they put him in the end with Vin Diesel, right? And, you know, he got the big blaster. And what does he say? X takes care of his own. Now, what's Triple X? What does it mean? What does Triple X mean? Now, some of us know Triple X, you know, in the world of pornography, world of porn, Triple X, right? But when he gets his role, where's he at? Oh, Darius Webb, he's a cold-blooded killer. He's locked up in a big-time, you know, concentration camp. And so what they do, they recruit him. Recruit him. Socially engineer him with them. Boom. Now, on one of his missions, he said, well, shit. He needs to make an extra move, pretty much like a move on his own. So what does he do? He relies on the hood. Relies on the hood. And what happens? They come through, and he with them. Now, here's a line. What does he do? Something like, nothing like, how does he go, in other words, saving America. Literally. You know, something like that. You know, coming through and saving America. That's by design. That's by design. So when our young people go see that role, they internalize it. It makes them feel good. And the only thing that they can save is anybody but they goddamn self. Now you let one of us make a movie whose conscience make that movie. And we'll reverse those lines around. Because we can save ourselves. There's nothing like the brothers from the hood coming through saving the Congo. from these ravenous, rapist wolves who they're raping Africa of its natural resources, particularly the uranium. And again, it goes back to that black scientist who's being shot with everything. His family ain't going to struggle no more. Going to buy mama the new house. And if the mama, if the grandmother too old to live on her own, then the mama will get a house made, and the grandmother going to stay there with her. And ain't nothing wrong with that. In a sense, ain't nothing wrong with it. But it's the bigger picture what we're talking about here. The bigger picture. Man, this is so much. Man, we could do a part five. It's so much. And we don't want to do just brush over shit. Like, one thing we pride ourselves in doing in defense of people is going into it intricately to literally paint a clear, vivid, intricate portrait for you while people to understand to get it. So shit can register. You wake up in the morning, shit, you know, your motor's still running. Your psychomotor, that is. Your psychomotor skills. Right? And that's what we would do. You know? And so the system of white supremacy has to keep constantly perpetuating itself. And these periods and these it's like a schedule. You know, you take a black actor and let alone a black actress. Let alone a black actress. And I'm gonna tell you, one of the most cold-hearted roles, one of the most vicious roles that they ever put a black woman through or in was Halle Berry and Monsters Ball. One of the most vicious movies of white supremacy if they can go deeper with it, what would it be? And then there's this uncut version I think that got leaked onto the internet, right? But they edited out of the movie. You know how to say the uncut version? All right. Well, this was cut out of the movie Monsters Ball. You know, the sex scene. And some of us actually believe that they actually having real sex. You know, the position they put Halle Berry in. The position they put Halle, and nobody knew who that white boy was. Nobody knew who that white boy was. What his name is? Billy Bob Thornton. Nobody knew who he was. Nobody. Nobody knew who he was. Everybody started knowing who Billy Bob Thornton was after that movie. Nobody hardly knew who he was. Well, I'll put it like this. If you got 10 people in the room, maybe one. And that's somebody who an avid movie watcher. But it was that role there that was so significant. I saw that movie. Went with some friends. And I sat up and up. I knew where the shit was going. And so I leaned over to my friends and I said, look, how much y'all want to bet Halle Berry won the Oscar for this, her and the white boy? I told them straight up. And that was before the scene with the sex scene. Now, ask yourself, who came up with the idea for that scene? Ask yourself. Ask yourself, who came up with the idea? I'm talking about the literal idea for them to be instructed on how the scene was supposed to take place. You know how some of these movies, they shoot movies, and at the end they show you the bloopers, right, when they were shooting? Like they did that for Harlem Nights, I believe. One of those movies, because it's Eddie Murphy and them and all that. I think it was Harlem Night. Well, you know how they show you the bloopers behind where they had to cut because they couldn't hold, couldn't keep a serious face. Eddie Murphy, he was just a natural, right? All right. Just imagine if they were showing, somebody was filming the director of that part of the movie and had him on camera, and what would you see? The ripping off of her, you know, clothes or her panties and stuff. He pushes her over, you know, onto the couch, and he rips, he's ripping her underwear off. Who came up with that scene? Who said it was supposed to be like that? Did Billy Bob Thornton improvise? Just think about it for a second. Just think about it for a second. Nah, I couldn't think of her name earlier. Angela Bassett. Knew it was going to come to me. Played the house, fella got a groove back. Angela Bassett was the one that they originally went to play that role. Angela Bassett read the script, the scenes and everything. She turned it down. And it was an article, I believe, in Jet, Everyman, Essence, one of those. And she spoke about it. She literally said that it was one of the most racist, despicable scenes that you would expect a black actress to play in. I'm not going to humiliate myself like that on screen. And, of course, Halle Berry took some flack for it. Took some flack for it. So you know what she did? Her counter, because there's always a counter attack, like you play tennis, with your body back and forth, right? All right. Her reason, her explanation, or her excuse was simply to say, well, they walk around in Africa, with no tops on, that in another movie that she played, the James Bond movie and all that shit whatever. And people are like, well, what's going on? And that's what she said. She said, well, women in Africa don't walk, and don't nobody say anything. Well, you ain't in Africa, right? You're not in Africa. I said, well, I tell you what, try that here in America. Try it in America. And so she's even internalized the white supremacist thought process. This primitivism, the black women in Africa, the primitive women in Africa, they walk around, without toppers, blah, blah. But yeah, nothing ever happens. So they walk right past the men. And nothing happens to them. They're sitting right next to them. This is supposed to be civilization, right? And Africa's supposed to be primitive. Africa's supposed to be place of the savages, the pagans, the primitive, the polytheists, and all that stuff, right? Again, the European construct of another group or another civilization or another people's country and culture, right? Okay, well, if this civilization, how come the women here in America, black women in America, can't walk around topless when it's hot? Walking down the street, going to the park or something. Or even going to the store or wherever. Walking down the street, putting, some coins in the meter at the parking. Go ahead, if this is civilization, right? That's what we told. That's what we told you. It's supposed to be civilization, right? Man, the contradictions are all over the place. And we want to bring them out, and we want to hide them, like Chairman Fred said. But that movie there, that's that role right there. Okay, let's look at it. Her old man, like the scissors like to say, right on, straight up. In prison on that rope. The usual stereotype. Fatherless son, single parent mom, working her ass off, living in a rural area, or what have you, has to walk miles down the road to go back and forth so a child could eat. And it's hot in the summertime. Hot as hell. Right? Hotter than July, like Steve Wonder named one of his albums. And so it just so happened to be. Just what a coincidence that old sheriff happened to be driving along the same road and just so happened to see her. the damsel in distress. Because, when the white man makes movies and the damsel in distress is white, ain't going to be no black man going to come rescue her. It's going to be him. It's going to be him. Now, here it is. He goes home after work, goes inside. He's got his old fogey, sloppy-looking daddy sitting in the chair, the rocking chair, whatever. right? Old primitive Paul. And what his Paul was, goddamn Klansman. Worst kind of racist. Again, it takes, you have to have a heck of an imagination to be a movie producer, you know, a storyteller. And some of us are. Some of us are. Boot that sad by the door. That's right, I said it. Sam Greenlee, 1973. And so here you got all of this going on, all this spinning in one movie, Monsters Ball. Monsters Ball, Monsters Ball. What is Monsters Ball? Monsters Ball. And so it got predictable when she was walking alongside the road. And you see the car. It got predictable. It was predictable that it was going to happen. She's a damsel in distress. Husband got about to get executed. She's stuck with her son. She can't raise a boy to be a man. And here this good white man comes along as the sheriff, whose paw is the overt devil, out in the open devil. You got two types. You got the overt white, who's just telling, I don't like niggas. And you got the covert white, who don't like niggas, but he'll stand right there with you on some liberalism shit in the flash. We're going to get into that, too. Like I said, man, it might last us three or four more shows. We ain't going anywhere. We ain't rushing. Only way we going somewhere is the great guy we know call us home. And so the scene takes place. You know, she's vulnerable. So he comes inside. You know, boom. And then you have the scene. You know, now, when you look at it and you understand how white supremacy works, then it would dawn on you that this is just no more than the continual rape of black women from the plantation forward. Just in the most subtle of ways in a movie. But the creator of the characters has the same mentality that old rapist George Washington. What was her name? Sally Hemings, I think. And when I learned about that, you know, I thought about, damn, all the people that I knew whose last name was Washington, they all was black. They're always black, like the actor Isaiah Washington, the Dallas Cowboys years ago had a defensive quarterback. His last name was Washington. The Washington Redskins had this little running back that played like he was a little nifty little running back named Joe Washington. And it just dawned on me, one Washington after the next. You know? But the same mentality that George Washington had, it's the same mentality that the creator of that white sheriff character. The same psychopathological mentality. One and the same. This is just in a more sophisticated way. After all, it's just a movie. Why are we getting so turned up, so emotional? It's just a movie where they know how to tap into your brainwave patterns. They've studied all of that. For instance, they made this movie years ago. What is it? The Compassion of the Christ or something like that? They went and got what? They went and got the white boy to play Jesus. And I read what, and I don't know how true this is, but I read where this white boy went and saw the movie. And he was so emotional. He was so emotional to the extent about guilt, in other words. He was so affected, emotionally affected by this Jesus, Passion of the Christ movie. And, of course, all the blood and gore. You know, that's another thing, the blood and gore, right? He was so overwhelmed by it that he confessed to a murder that he committed years ago, and he had gotten away
what they call it, Scot-Free. And that movie had such a profound effect on his psyche that he confessed to a murder. And the family, on his dime, got justice. Picture that. Just picture that. And so Halle Berry won her Oscar. How come she didn't win it for Bull Durham? Played in a movie called Bulwark. The movie Bulwark was politically charged about consciousness. About what? About how the shit really goes behind the scenes in the world of politics. You know, the so-called debate. You know, candidates debate. Where they're already given a sort of a preview of what the question is going to be like. So that way they can have a prepared answer for it. And like one time Obama was speaking. Right? They went from the little paper on the podium where he can look down every so on, to an electronic screen, I believe, on the podium. Right? From that to the teleprompter. The teleprompter is right above the lens, and the camera is at such a distance that it looks like he's looking right through the camera, but he's actually looking at the teleprompter. So he's looking at the teleprompter, and he's reading off the shit off the teleprompter because the words are going up, right? Not down, they're going up. And it moves at a pace of his reading level, right? So one time he was speaking, the teleprompter fell out. He was on his own. He was stuck. He was on his own. So that's what Bullwood was about. Warren Beatty played in the movie. Halle Berry plays this character where she's from the hood. She's from the hood. So she's from the hood. Everybody knows her. Right? Just like Natalie in the other movie, Mo Money, whatever. What Mo Money? I can't think of the name of it. But anyway, she's from the hood. So when they needed some help, they went got the hood. You know, when they got some trouble, shit, the hood, you know, the brothers came. Right? So why she didn't win it for that? No. She wasn't going to win it for that. You're not going to win it for that. She went for Monsters Ball. Take Denzel. Same thing. Everybody in their mama knows who was saying. Everybody in their mama knows that Denzel had the best acting job when he played who? Malcolm X. Even Kim Basinger, the white girl who hosted the Oscars that year. Where Malcolm X movie was eligible to win it. Because it came out late, so it wasn't eligible. Like, it had to go around. And when the movie came eligible, boom, Kim Basinger hosted the Oscars. When he didn't win it, even Denzel himself, he was livid. I love using some of these terms sometimes. He was livid. Well, we know it is pissed off. The nigga was mad as shit because he didn't win. Everybody in their mama knew, hands down, who's supposed to win that award. But he didn't win it. That was his crowning moment to play the late, great Malcolm X, a.k.a. name change, El Hajj Malik El Shabazz, a.k.a. St. Omar White. And he run out of time. But what did he win it for? You gonna win no movie calling a white man the devil. Casting America to flames. Chickens coming home to roost. You know. Telling the black man, you don't let no man slap one cheek. and then turn and let him slap the other cheek. That's suicide. So he went in for what? Training day. What was training day? And here's the cold part about training day. The nigga who directed the movie, who created the movie. Okay? What was his name? But yeah, it's a black dude, Antoine Fuqua. Antoine Fuqua, if I'm pronouncing it right, because the U is like a W. Antoine Fuqua, a black man. When I saw the movie, I said, oh, yes, here they go the white man, usual tricks. You know, the good guys, the good cops, the white cops, the bad cops, black cops. Same shit with Lion King. The two lions, light line was the good line, dark line was the bad line. Some people raised tail. Some people raised tail over there. Now, that's what conscious people who raised tail over there. So it was the same scenario, same thing. But the director was black. So how in the world did that happen? How did that happen? How did that happen? The tentacles of white supremacy. And I believe this is the same Antoine Fuqua who I guess fooled around on his wife. I'm not laughing, you know, in the sense that is insensitive or inconsiderate of his wife. I'm laughing because of something else in the sense that it's cold. Antoine Fuqua's wife is the same sister whose name escaped me. They played in Harlem Nights. She set the white boy up, Sunshine. I can't get her real name out, but I know her nickname. I've been socialized. I know Sunshine. And Sunshine got the white boy, called his wife, and said, Junior at the phone, and said, what, Junior? Tell your mama I ain't never coming home again. That's why I'm laughing. You know. But he won a movie with Denzel for Training Day. A crooked pig. A crooked pig. Who else? Let's look at all the black people who won Oscars. Morgan Freeman. Morgan Freeman won an Oscar for what? Driving Miss Daisy. Old, focused, older white woman. They made the white woman appear to be more humanistic than he was. And loved black people more than he loved himself. Oh, Miss Daisy. I mean, it's amazing. Absolutely amazing, man. Who else won the Oscar? What's the little girl from Africa, the little dark-skinned girl that played with the 12 Years a Slave, I believe? She won the Oscar, right? Now, she was selectively chosen. She was chosen on purpose, for a purpose. She's an indigenous African. A dark-skinned African, they made sure that when they got her, that role, right? Okay, so this dude, some so-called black dude, same dude who borrowed money from Damon Dash, never paid him back his money, right? By design. And she won the Oscar for playing a slave. Now, let's look at it. Denzel was the slave. Black version of the slave catcher on the plantation. An internalized white man. Morgan Freeman, the usual slave. The post so-called emancipation slave. The Reconstruction Jim Crow slave. On into modern times. And of course, Lupe, I think it's her first name, a natural slave depicted in the movie. And that's the tentacles of white, that's what it does. And what does it do? The movie told it, lobotomizes our children. That's what it does. And even the movie Queen and Slim. Now, there's more than one way you can look at it. Like I said, you know, I was with it all the way up to the end. You know what I'm saying? This so-called sacrifice, you know, without arms, you know, the damsel in distress. So they all some movie, all of them, even Spike Lee. Now, he made what? Black Klansman. And he won film festival. They took care of everything. It won the film festival. Black Klansman. He wanted us to know that some black dude using his voice, you know, infiltrate the Klan, put on the white voice, you know, speak, you know, proper English, you know, the Queen's English. Man, we're at the end, man. We're going to pick this up again next week. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. And we'd like to thank those who've been listening to In Defense of the People Radio, the People's Radio, brought to you by People's Political Party. I'm the National Chairman, Brother Nat Turner, one of your co-hosts, other co-hosts, Brother Motherland, our National Men of Defense, and our assault technician, a technician on the ones and two, our sister Amina Oshun, who is our National Men of Communication. And we'll be back next week, 7 p.m. Central, 8 p.m. Eastern Time. All power, black power. You hear roll.
Thing. Yo, look at Grinch with them stupid bell-bottom pants, man.
Your shoes, man, they make you look like a fool.
Word!
While you dive, turkeys, I'll knock you through Sunday and be waiting for you on Monday. You're too young to have seen the sights of Esther Mammy and Pappy about Dolomite.
Planet Earth was my place of birth, born to be the sole controller of the universe. Besides the part of the map, I hit first. Any environment I can adapt. When it gets worse, the rough gets going, the going gets rough. When I start blowing the mic, mic bust. The next day to shake from the power I generate. People in Cali used to think it was earthquakes. Cause times is hard on the boulevard. So I fold guard and never get scarred. I'm guard, but it seems like I'm locked in hell. Looking over the edge, but the R never fell. A trip to slip, cause my knife got gripped. Stand on my own 2 feet and come equipped. Any stage I'm seen on, a mic I fiend on. I stand alone and need nothing to lean on. Going for self with a long way to go. So much to say, but I still flow slow. I come correct and I won't look back. Cause it ain't where you're from, it's where you're at. Even the
nobody smiling.
In my room and escape from New York and return through the wound of the world as a thought. Thinking how hard it was to be born. Me being queen with no physical form. Playing yourself with one destination. To reach the best part, it's life creation. 9 months later, a job well done. Make way, cause here I come. Since I made it this far, I can't stop now. There's a will and a way, and I got the know-how to be all I can be and more. And